Today, banking on the future. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly, the 29th of September 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Another mega week with the Royal Commission interim report out, the Fed lifting rates, APRA releasing their banking stress tests, more class actions launched, and banks lifting their provisions to cover the costs of remediation. So let's get stuck in. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. The Royal Commission interim report came out on Friday and turned the spotlight on the greed that's driving financial services to sell at all costs, take fees from dead people, and reward anti-customer behaviour. The report also called into question the role of the regulators, saying that they were weak and did not do their job. In fact, it's not the lack of appropriate law, but it's the non-compliance without consequences which is the issue. And they also raised the question of the structure of the industry. We discussed this in an ABC Radio National program alongside journalist Adele Ferguson and ex-ACCC boss Graham Samuel, and also in our show Inside the Royal Commission Interim Report. The Royal Commission has touched on the critical issues which need to be considered, but now we have to take the thinking further. In terms of structure, we should be thinking about how to break up the financial services sector into smaller, more manageable entities that are not too big to fail. We should separate insurance from wealth management and from core banking, and separate advice from product selling and manufacturing. There is clearly an opportunity to implement Glass-Steagall, which separates risky speculative activity from core meat and potatoes banking. There is a big job to do in terms of cultural change within the organisations as they shift to customer centricity, meaning building their businesses around their customers. This requires different thinking right from the top. Also, regulators have clearly not been effective because they were too close and too captured. This must be addressed. The industry has played them, being prepared to pay small penalties if they get caught, just as a cost of doing business, but without real consequences. Poor culture is rife across the industry and across regulators. For example, LF Economics' Lindsay David tried under an FOI request to get APRA to release details of its targeted reviews into the mortgage sector from 2016. The review was never intended to be made public, but was revealed during the Hayne Royal Commission. It found that at Westpac, for example, only 1 in 10 of banks' lending controls were operating effectively. In fact, APRA had ordered these targeted reviews in October 2016, and they were conducted by PwC at Westpac and CBA. On the 12th of October 2016, APRA issued a letter to the bank and 4 other large banks requesting that they undertake a review into the risks of potential misrepresentation of mortgage borrowing financial information used in loan serviceability assessments. In its letter, APRA referenced assertions made by commentators that fraud and manipulation of ADI residential mortgage origination practices were relatively commonplace. Frankly, the fact that these were all buried and that APRA still refuses to disclose what went on tells us more about APRA than anything else. After all, we know mortgage fraud was widespread. In this light, the APRA stress test results is on the same theme, high level and vague, compared, for example, with the bank-by-bank data that the Fed releases. It is really very high level. In APRA's view, the results of the 2017 exercise provide a degree of reassurance. ADIs remained above regulatory minimum levels in what was a very severe stress scenario, they say. Now, John Adams and I discussed this recently in our post, The Great airbrush scandal. APRA, frankly, is just not convincing. ASIC revealed this week that it has identified serious, unacceptable delays in the time taken to identify, report, and correct significant breaches of the law among Australia's most important financial institutions. It can, they say, take over 4.5 years to identify that a breach incident has occurred. ASIC chair said, "Many of the delays in breach reporting and compensating consumers were due to the financial institution's inadequate systems, procedures, and governance processes, as well as a lack of a consumer-orientated culture of escalation." So now, there is a growing sense of panic as, according to The Australian, for example, from APRA, who says a horde of Australia's biggest financial institutions and superannuation funds have been forced by the prudential regulator to run through an in-depth review of their culture and governance before the Royal Commission ends next year. After copping heavy criticism over the course of Kenneth Hayne's Royal Commission over a lack of enforcement in the financial sector, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority has demanded that Westpac, ANZ and National Australia Bank mimic the landmark cultural investigation of Commonwealth Bank, the regulator launched late last year. Along with the major banks, some of the nation's biggest union and employment-backed super funds, such as the $40 billion Host Plus, the $35 billion fund CBUS, and the $50 billion REST Superfund, have also been asked by APRA to review their culture. And panic from the industry, for example, as the AFR reported that Westpac hauled each of its 40,000 bankers into urgent briefings by Chief Executive Brian Hartzer this week before the Royal Commission report came out, who warned them to bring forward customer problems. Westpac also announced that cash earnings in the financial year 2018 will be reduced by an estimated $235 million following continued work on addressing customer issues and from provisions relating to recent litigation. This included increased provisions for customer refunds associated with certain advice fees charged by the group's salaried financial planners due to more detailed analysis going right back to 2008. These include where advice services were not provided, as well as where they have not been able to sufficiently verify that advice services were provided. Increased provisions for refunds to customers who may have received inadequate financial advice from Westpac planners, additional provisions to resolve legacy issues as part of the group's detailed product reviews, provisions for costs of implementing the three remediation processes above, and estimated provisions for recent litigation, including costs and penalties associated with the already disclosed responsible lending and BBSW cases. Costs associated with the responding to the Royal Commission are not included in these amounts. So already we estimate that across the industry more than $1 billion has been put aside and there is more to come. And of course, guess who will ultimately pick up the tab for these expenses? Yes, we, the customers, will pay. Another class action was announced this week as law firm Slater and Gordon said that it had filed class action proceedings in the federal court against National Australia Bank and MLC on behalf of customers sold worthless credit card insurance. Most were existing NAB customers, and the bank should have known, they say, that insurance was likely to be of little or no benefit to them. Despite knowing this, NAB has continued to push the insurance widely, reaping millions in premiums while doing so. Most people were sold these insurance products over the phone and were not given a reasonable opportunity to understand the terms and conditions of the policy. Elsewhere, we continue to debate the trajectory of home price falls as Media Watch discussed the 60 Minutes segment that we were featured in. Once again, somewhat martic views were expressed by host Paul Barry, as we discussed on our recent post. You can also watch the 60 Minutes segment on YouTube which covers my views more comprehensively. Prices are set to fall further, period. And I'm not alone in saying that. Realestate.com.au says that according to a survey of property experts and economists, further falls in housing prices across Australia are expected. They suggest an 8.2% fall in home prices in Sydney, an 8.1% fall in Melbourne, and a 7% fall in Brisbane. In fact, all centres are expected to see a fall. Finder.com.au insights manager Graham Cook was quoted as saying that the cooling market conditions made it harder for existing homeowners to build up equity, but there could be good news for first-time home buyers with a deposit in hand. If you're thinking of getting into the market over the next few years, hold out until prices have dropped further and use this time to save for your upfront costs, he said. Right now, there's no need to jump on the first suitable property you find. Waiting a few years could potentially save you thousands of dollars. Exactly. And Damien Boy at Credit Suisse said this week that by the start of 2020, Sydney house prices could have dropped by 15 to 20% from their 2017 peak. The market is heavily oversupplied even before we consider the risks of high insolvency activity and foreclosures, he said. He argues that demand is the problem, not credit supply. We could ease lending standards from here and still not cause housing demand to bounce back. Investors cannot sustain capital growth by themselves. They need a greater pool to on-sell their houses to. And foreign demand is weak, and first home buyers are priced out of the market. Specifically, Chinese demand for property is weak, as evidenced by low levels of outward direct investment and the failure of the Australian dollar to rise in response to the yuan weakness. Promised relaxation of capital controls has not eventuated, and the yuan devaluation pressure has had a negative impact on credit conditions, as well as the ability of Chinese residents to export capital abroad. And finally, dwelling completions are still rising in response to high levels of building approvals from more than a year ago. The building lead time has lengthened significantly. As for the RBA, any rate cuts from here are unlikely to be passed on in full to end borrowers, given counterparty credit risk concerns in the interbank markets. And the latest UBS Global Housing Bubble Index came out and showed that Sydney had slipped from 4th to 11th in a year. They noted that prices peaked last summer and have slid moderately as tighter lending conditions reduced affordability, particularly since the land tax surcharge more than doubled and a vacancy fee was introduced. The high end of the market has suffered most. The vacancy rate on the rental market has also climbed. Nevertheless, inflation-adjusted prices are still 50% higher than 5 years ago, while rents and incomes have grown at only single-digit rates. And CoreLogic reported further price falls this week in Sydney, down 0.57%, Melbourne down 0.79%, Adelaide down 0.19%, Perth down 0.73%, while Brisbane rose a little up 0.06%. Melbourne looks to be the weakest centre currently, and we continue to expect to see further falls. CoreLogic says that last week 2,404 homes went to auction across the combined capital cities, and they returned a final auction clearance rate of 52.4%, slightly higher than the 51.8% the previous week, which was the lowest seen since December 2012. Over the same time last year, 2,782 homes went to auction, and then the clearance rate was 66.2%. Melbourne's final clearance rate was recorded at 53.8% across 1,161 auctions last week, compared with 54.1% across a lower 988 auctions the previous week. And this time last year, a higher 1,361 homes were taken to auction across the city, and a much stronger clearance rate of 70.6% was recorded. Sydney's final auction clearance rate came in at 51.1% across 851 auctions last week, up from 48.6% across 669 auctions over the previous week. And over the same week last year, 1,083 Sydney homes went to auction, returning a final clearance rate of 65.9%. And across the smaller auction markets, clearance rates improved across Adelaide and Tasmania, while Brisbane, Canberra and Perth saw clearance rates fall week on week. And of the non-capital city auction markets, the Geelong region was the best performing in terms of clearance rate at 61.1%, followed by the Hunter region, where 58.8% of homes sold. And the combined capital cities are expecting 65% fewer homes taken to market this week, with half the nation on an upcoming public holiday, combined with both the NRL and AFL grand finals both being held over the weekend. So it looks to be a quiet week on the auction markets. And finally, the latest RBA and APRA lending statistics, plus the June quarter household ratios, shows that credit growth is still too strong, with the 12-month growth by category showing that owner-occupied lending is still growing at 7.5% annualised, while investment home loans have fallen to 1.5% on an annual basis. Overall, housing lending is growing at 5.4%, compared with APRA's growth of 4.5% over the same period, so it shows that the non-banks are clearly taking up some of the slack. Still, those rates are much higher than wages and inflation. Household debt, therefore, continues to rise, and the non-bank sector, which is derived from subtracting the ADI credit from the RBA data, shows a significant rise, up 5% last month, in terms of owner-occupied loans. APRA needs to look at the non-banks, and quickly. This was confirmed looking at the rising household debt-to-income ratios, where, in short, the debt-to-income is up again to 190.5, and the ratio of interest payments to income is up, meaning that households are paying more of their income to service their debts, and the ratio of debt to home values are falling. All three of these are warnings. The policy settings are just not right. And you can watch our show, What Does the Latest Data Tell Us? But for now, it's worth highlighting that despite all the grizzles from the property spruikers, mortgage lending is still growing and faster than inflation. We have not tamed the debt beast so far, despite falling home prices. There is no justification to ease lending standards, none. So to a quick look at the markets, the ASX 200 Financial Sector Index was up 1.2% on Friday to close at 6,127 in a relief rally that the Royal Commission report was not worse and the prospect of less regulation was mooted. We think this will reverse as the full implications of the report are digested. But of course, the market profits from volatility. CBA, the biggest owner-occupied mortgage lender, was up 1.9% to close at 71.41, despite some analysts now suggesting a fair price closer to $65. Both are a long way from the $81 it reached in January. It will not return there anytime soon. Westpac rose 1.16% to close at 27.93, still well off its November 2017 highs of 33.50. National Australia Bank rose 1.76% to 27.81, and ANZ closed at 28.10, up 1.4%. ANP, who has already been hit hard by the Royal Commission, rose 1.59% to 3.19, still way down on its March highs before the revelations came out. Macquarie Group fell 1.34% and ended at 126.04, and Suncorp ended at 14.46, up 0.84%, and Bendigo and Adelaide Bank rose 1.22% to 10.75. The Aussie ended up a little at 72.22, 0.19% higher on Friday. But with still more falls expected ahead, we think it could test $71 quite soon. And so over to the US markets, where the Dow Jones Industrial ended at 26,458, up 0.07%, but off its recent highs. The Nasdaq ended up 0.05% to 8,046, while the S&P 500 was flat at 2,913. The volatility index was lower at 1212, down 2.34%. The bulls are, in the short term at least, firmly in control. Gold was up 0.74% to 1,196, but still in lower regions than last year, reacting to the strength of the US dollar. Oil was higher again, up 1.41% to 73.53. In fact, until sizable supplies offered up by OPEC, some are suggesting that we could see prices above $100 per barrel, but $100 seems an overreach on the current charts. On the currencies, the yuan, US dollar was up 0.31% to 14.56 as China continues to manage their rate lower. Of course, the trade wars are in full play. President Trump has announced a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth in Chinese imports. That tariff is currently 10%, but at the end of 2018, it's expected to rise to 25%. This is the third round of tariff. Back in July, we had $34 billion worth of Chinese goods tariffed. Then in August, we had a follow-up of $16 billion in tariffs. So this is really a huge jump up to the $200 billion. This is affecting all kinds of goods. The US brings in a little over $500 billion worth of goods from China each year, so the $250 billion so far is roughly half. But Trump has said that if China were to take retaliatory action on these tariffs, which of course they have in fact done, he's going to put in place another $267 billion worth of import tariffs. For all intents and purposes, this will put a tariff in place on 100% of US-China trade. China also announced some tariffs on $60 billion worth of goods that also went into effect on September the 24th. The total US-China trade is around $130 billion of imports. This second round of Chinese tariffs is going to now cover $110 billion of the $130 billion of US-China trade. Again, almost 100% of the entire trading relationships. So this is pretty significant in that almost all the cards have been played here. If all the threats and allegations with regard to tariffs are followed through, all of US-China trade is set to be under some kind of tariff barrier in 2018. This would be a big deal. The 10-year bond rate was up 0.29% to 3.065 after the Fed rate hike this week. The Fed moved as expected and continues to highlight more upward movements in the months ahead. In fact, their language is arguably more bullish now. The target range for the federal funds rate is now 2 to 2.25%. In their projections release, they see GDP sliding from 2019 onwards, while inflation is expected to rise. The three-month rate was up 0.35% on Friday to 2.207, still signalling a recession risk down the track. We discussed the impact of the US rate move in our show, The Fed Lifts, More Ahead, and What Are the Consequences? We think the US corporate bond market is the key here, and we discussed this in our video, Is a US Corporate Meltdown on the Cards? Finally, turning to crypto, Bitcoin ended up 1.43% to 6,617. Little sign of new directions here, at least in the short term. So in summary, a week dominated by the Royal Commission locally against a backcloth of higher international interest rates and elevated risks. We are, as they say, set for some interesting times ahead. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. As always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting the subscribe bell. And if you've already subscribed, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal and Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.